before anybody else was willing to help. It was this organization that provided some of the initial financial assistance that helped those tribes in the very early days to do some of the research that ultimately led to the claims that we're litigating today. I think that what I know of the organization is characteristic of the kind of far-sighted involvement that it's had in crucial Indian issues for a great many years in the United States. And my clients are certainly grateful for its existence and for what it's done so far. In any event, I want to talk with you this evening about an issue that you may or may not know much about. There's been a fair amount of attention given to the claims in Maine. I sometimes wonder how much people understand from all that attention. The issues are somewhat complicated, but they're understandable. And what I want to do is spend a little time now telling you about the cases, telling you primarily what's taken place until now, and then leave a half hour or so at the end for questions, because I've found in talking about the case that there are usually lots of questions that are in people's heads, and that's a very valuable part of it. To understand the claims in Maine, you've got to understand a little bit about federal Indian law. And so at the beginning, I'm going to put you through a relatively short history and legal lesson. But you really have to have this fundamental understanding to understand what's going on in Maine. First thing you've got to understand about, the first idea that you've got to understand is Aboriginal title. From the very beginning, when the Europeans came to this country, they recognized the Indians' ownership interest in their land. From the very outset, the Europeans, not particularly because they wanted to, but because they had to, the Europeans recognized, and their legal system took account of the fact, that the Indians had an ownership interest in the land that they occupied. Indeed, they recognized and dealt with the natives as sovereign entities who owned the land that they occupied. Now, to have Aboriginal rights, which is what the concept came to be known as, you didn't have to have a deed. A specific recognition of the Aboriginal rights wasn't necessary. Just as a matter of fact, you simply had to use and occupy the land as an Indian tribe. If you held, used, and occupied land in the New World, you had Aboriginal title to it. And your ownership interest in the tribe's rights in the land were recognized and protected by the European sovereign that came here until such time as those rights were legally extinguished. Now, you say, well, what did the Europeans get out of all the trouble that they went to come over here and discover this place? And what they got was something nonetheless very valuable. What they got was a preemptive right, exclusive of all of the other European sovereigns, to deal with the Indians in the area discovered for the purpose of extinguishing the Indians' claim to the land in that area. So the King of England, for example, by virtue of having his subjects come over and discover New England, acquired the exclusive right to deal with the natives in that area and to obtain their land either through conquest or through purchase. And in New England, it was universally done through purchase. But by virtue of discovery, the discovering sovereign, did not get title to the land or the right to possess and use the land in the New World. The sovereign only got this right to negotiate with the Indians for the purpose of buying the land. But that was nonetheless very valuable, because the King of England, it meant that the King of England could, for example, keep the King of France away while he, the King of England, dealt with the natives in New England, for example. And that when those natives were ready to depart with their land, it was the King of England that would have the right to acquire the full possessory right to it. And of course, once the Indian rights were extinguished, then you had something very valuable. Then you had something that you could sell, subdivide, build houses and meeting houses on, and just generally cash in. So the Europeans were very concerned about their rights by virtue of discovery. And in fact, they fought a lot over this. And many of the wars that went on during the colonial era were tug of wars between say, you know, the various European sovereigns, France and England and Spain and Holland, would fight against one another to push one another out of a given area, so that in the process of doing that, the King of France, for example, by pushing the British out of an area that that Britain was trying to establish a foothold in, the King of France got the right to acquire the property from the Indians instead of the King of England. Now, all of this was relatively neat and simple until the revolution took place. Because prior to the revolution, you would have one sovereign in a given area who had the right to deal with the natives. Now, that sovereign had the right to regulate commerce with the Indians and had the right to buy their land from them when and if they could be convinced to part with it. When the revolution took place, it got a little more complicated, because instead of substituting one sovereign, one new sovereign for the old one that had been here, instead of substituting one America for Britain that had been here before, we had to go and substitute 14 sovereigns. And we substituted the federal government and the 13 original states, which had overlapping powers and competing interests. Now, as I said a minute ago, there were two elements. The Europeans, by virtue of discovery, acquired two things with regard to the natives. One was the power to regulate commerce with the Indians in the discovered area. And the other was this property right. The first was a governmental power, the second was a property interest, the right to deal with the natives to purpose of buying their land when and if they were ready to sell. That's something akin to like a right of first refusal. If somebody has a house that you want to buy very badly, but they don't want to sell, you say, well, maybe at least you'll give me a right of first refusal. You'll agree that when you do want to sell, I can buy it. What happened when the revolution took place is that these two interests, which the Europeans previously had, or which the King of England previously had, these two interests split up. The power to regulate commerce with the Indians, which was a federal a vestige of sovereignty, that passed to the federal government. But the power, the right of purchase, what was called the ultimate fee to the Indians' land, or the preemptive right of purchase, that went to the original states, because the states got any property that the crown left lying around at the time of the revolution. And one of the property rights that the crown had was this right to deal with the natives for the purpose of buying their land. And so as soon as the revolution took place, the seeds of dispute and controversy were sown, because the power to regulate commerce with Indians throughout the United States, which is an aspect of sovereignty, passed to the federal government along with all other sovereign powers. Whereas the power to purchase, the right to purchase the land from the natives when and if they were willing to sell, within the original 13 states, passed to those original 13 states. The right to buy the land from the natives outside of the original 13 states went to the federal government, because outside of the original 13 states, we had federal domain. The land didn't start off as a state. It started off as part of a federal domain and was only made a state later. Texas was the only exception. We don't have to get into Texas right now. But outside of the original 13 states, the federal government had not only the power to regulate commerce with the Indians, but also had the right to purchase the land from the Indians. And as states were created in the West, the federal government kept this power to itself. In the East, the federal government had only the power to regulate commerce. It did not have the right of purchase. But when the Constitution was adopted, the federal government kept to itself the power of regulating transactions with Indians throughout the United States. And in 1790, the very first Congress passed the Indian Trade and Intercourse Act, which provided that no transaction involving Indian land would be of any validity whatsoever in law or equity unless it was approved by the federal government, unless it was accomplished by means of a treaty or convention held pursuant to the Constitution. So it became the law in 1790, if there had been any reason for any doubt, that throughout the United States, the federal government had to approve the land transactions. Now, in the West, it was a relatively simple matter, because the federal government was the one that conducted the land transactions. It was the federal government that did the purchasing, because the federal government had the right to purchase. And as states were created, the federal government kept that right to itself. In the East, you had a potentially confusing situation because the states had the right to buy the land. Now, all of the people who were involved in the founding of this country, I shouldn't say anything this nasty. Many of the people who were involved in the founding of this country were land speculators. You would be surprised how many of the people who were involved in the founding of this country and how many of the people that you would otherwise think and probably think today were the finest and most sterling characters. To a man, they were virtually all land speculators. Now, one of the biggest ways to hustle money back then, if you were a land speculator, was in Indian land speculating. Because if you could get hold of those preemptive rights to Indian land, if you could acquire the preemptive right of purchase, and you were then in a position to extinguish the Indians' possessory rights, and once you did that, you had complete title. And whereas the right to deal with the Indians was maybe something that you could acquire very cheaply, once you extinguished the Indians' rights, you had complete title, something which you could subdivide to sell and make a whole lot of money on. So there was a great deal of interest in this business of Indian rights and just what you had to do to effectuate a purchase from the Indians. And jealousy developed between the federal government and the original states over what kind of formalities were required for dealing with the tribes. And out of this grew a lot of confusion, because what happened was that in the few places where they could get away with it, the original 13, the people, the high rollers in the original 13 states, went ahead and attempted to buy land from Indians without the approval of the federal government. I mean, think about it. If you had held the preemptive rights to Indian land, somehow you would acquire these, because sometimes the states sold them. If you were the one that had the option on the Indian land, and you had a chance to go out and make a deal with them, and you had two choices. Either you could go out there and sit down with them in a room all by yourself and say, come on, guys, let's get together and your land, you know, this is a fair enough price. You had the choice of doing that, or you had the choice of getting some disinterested bureaucrat from the federal government in, whose job it was to make sure that the transaction was absolutely fair, and that the Indians, you know, would sell no more land than they absolutely had to, and that they would be protected and put in a position where they could prosper. In other words, you had the choice of either doing it by yourself or having the trustee present. And the trustee's job is to live up to the highest standards, you know, and make sure that nothing is done for his beneficiary that isn't proper, that isn't absolutely proper. And in this case, the beneficiary had so much land that if the trustee had done the job, of course, the beneficiaries would have wound up being very wealthy, because they were really in the position of an heir to a very vast fortune, you know, who was being protected by a good trustee. If you had the choice of going out and making a quick deal on your own, or getting the trustee involved and having the trustee ponder whether it was entirely fair and whether this was the best thing for the next 100 years for this tribe, you can bet what the temptation would be. And if you're suspecting that some of these good souls wanted to conclude transactions with Indians without the trustee being present, that's you're entirely correct, because that's what they did, where they could get away with it. Now, the fact of the matter is they couldn't get away with it in very many places. In most parts of the East, the Indian land got sold with the consent of the federal government. The great bulk of the land in the East got sold in transactions that were either federally supervised or which took place before the creation of the United States and took place validly under colonial law. The Creeks and the Cherokees, for example, in the Southeast, were so powerful that the states simply could not deal with them. They had to call on the federal government. They were willing to give up their preemptive rights if the feds would just get rid of those Indians. That's where the Trail of Tears ultimately came from. In New England, so much of the land was gone under colonial law, had been purchased by the early settlers in southern New England. In New York, much of the Indian land, many of the Iroquois tribes had been hostile during the Revolution, and much of their land got sold in federal treaties because, on the one hand, New York maybe was afraid to do it on their own, although they tried in many instances, but primarily the federal government was so concerned about the Iroquois tribes who had been hostile during the Revolution, which a number of the Iroquois tribes had been, that they wanted to make sure that the state of New York didn't rip them off, because that, they knew, would lead to another revolution, another war. What I'm saying is that in most places in the East, despite this potential for confusion and greed, most of the transactions were legal. In the West, of course, they virtually all were legal, because in the West there was no question. The federal government had the preemptive right of purchase, and the federal government was the trustee. And so not only were they legal, but there wasn't a whole lot of room for independent judgment there. And the and the trust notion didn't work out too well, because it was the trustee that was doing the purchasing. And you didn't have exactly the kind of pristine situation that you would like to have. But in any event, the transactions in the West, nonetheless, were strictly legal. They met the letter of the law. Now, when I say strictly legal, I mean that they met the letter of the Non-Intercourse Act. The Non-Intercourse Act says that no transfer of any interest in any Indian property will be of any validity in law or equity unless the transaction is accomplished by means of a treaty or convention held pursuant to the Constitution. And what all that means is that no transaction involving Indian land will be of any validity whatsoever unless the federal government consents to it. And that if you get a deed, it will be absolutely void. The business about it being of no validity in law or equity means that the mere passage of time can't make it legal, that you simply get nothing. Now, as I've said, 99% of the Indian land in the United States got sold in transactions which met the letter of the law. And therefore, most of the tribes, virtually all of the tribes in the United States, are simply out of luck when it comes to trying to get their land back. I'm not saying the land wasn't taken unfairly or fraudulently. I mean, it was. That history is clear. It speaks for itself. But the fact is that the transactions technically were legal. We've got something called the political question doctrine, which says that the courts cannot look behind a federal treaty, a treaty which on its face is valid. Because if Congress ratified it, then Congress is, you know, presumed to have been acting fairly and properly, and you don't get to look behind it. Political question doctrine is devastating. The fact of the matter is that the tribes in the West, by and large, and most of the tribes in the East, were in a situation where, at best, they had moral claims. And the United States has acted on those moral claims. The United States, in 1946, set up the Indian Claims Commission and made it very clear. They said, no, we don't have to do this. We're not required to do this. But our moral sense tells us that we should do this. And we are going to allow tribes to come into this special commission that we set up. And if they can demonstrate that they were dealt with unfairly or improperly, we will authorize this commission to make some token monetary payments. And virtually every tribe in the country has been through the Indian Claims Commission, and most, if not all of them, well, not all of them, many of them have in fact received token monetary payments through the Indian Claims Commission. No land gets returned, and the average award has turned out to be something like a couple hundred bucks. But that's something, a couple hundred dollars per capita, on a per capita basis. Not enough to change anything. You know, it's an award on the par with the kind of tax rebate that presidents from time to time think about and sometimes get through. But it's something. You know, it's something. Now, the Indians in the East, though, there are a handful of situations in the East where the tribes are in a different situation, where their land was taken in transactions that weren't federally approved. Most, by and large, this occurred in situations where the tribes had been friendly during the Revolution, or were not any kind of real political or practical physical threat. In Maine, for example, you had two tribes who hadn't sold any of their land as of the time of the Revolution, had aboriginal title to about half of the state, 10 million acres or so, who had participated in the Revolution at the request of George Washington, who had negotiated a treaty with the federal government during, or with a federal agent during the war, in which the federal government promised that the Indians would help out to protect their land forever and provide them with supplies in time of need. But who after the war, because they had been friendly, were dropped, were just flat forgotten. The treaty that was negotiated by the agent, although the Indians ratified it, and in fact acted upon it, fulfilled their part of the bargain, was never ratified by the United States Congress. Now, and these tribes were simply abandoned in the sense that the federal government just didn't pay any attention to them. And the reason the federal government didn't pay any attention to them, I think, is because they didn't have to worry about them. It was a very pragmatic decision. The government, it's hard to conceive of the federal government being weak, but at that time it was, comparatively speaking. And the government spent a little bit of time that it had to worry about Indians, worrying about Indians who had been hostile during the Revolution. And the tribes in Maine got forgotten about. And in 1794, in 1796, in 1818, and in 1833, the state of Maine, Massachusetts first, and then Maine became responsible for these acts afterwards when it was carved out of Massachusetts in 1820 as part of the Missouri Compromise. Massachusetts and Maine entered into a series of treaties with these tribes in which they went from owning 10 million acres, or having good aboriginal title to 10 million acres, down to today having title of something like 20,000 acres. And they were paid just about nothing for the land. So, you know, a few token payments in the Penobscot treaties. The Passamaquoddies got absolutely zippo. They relinquished their claim to all land, and in return were allowed to continue to occupy 23,000 acres of land that they already had aboriginal title to. A pretty shabby history. Now, in 1964, something happened on the Passamaquoddy Reservation. A car dealer and a guy who had hunting camps were up playing poker one night. These are both non-Indians. And the car dealer ran out of money. And he put up in the poker game the deed to a small piece of property that he had across the street from his Ford dealership, which was next door to the hunting lodge place. And the Ford dealer lost that hand and lost the deed, and it went to the other guy. Now, the piece of property that got transferred was a piece of property on Indian Township. Indian Township back in 1794 in that reservation was supposed to be 23,000 acres. Today it's somewhere between 15,000 and 17,000 acres. Nobody's ever surveyed it very carefully. I think it's probably 15,000. Now, the piece of land that changed hands in that card game was what was known as an alienated lot. It was a small parcel, one of many that the state has either given away or given 999-year leases on. It's hard to say that, 999-year leases on. Or simply has sold outright on the tribe in the last 150 years. It's right next to what has always been an Indian settlement at a place called The Strip. It's a settlement crowded in between Route 1 and Louis Lake, in right next to Princeton, Maine. Now, that piece of land hadn't been ever built on, hadn't been cleared, and it was right next to this Indian settlement. But it changed hands in this card game, and the guy who owned the hunting camps the next spring started clearing the land. Well, the state had been taking land and taking land and taking land from the Passamaquoddies since 1794, even before that. And this piece of land became the turning point, because it was this piece of land that made the tribe say, "You're not going to take any more land from us. This is the last piece." It was 1964 when people did things like sit-ins. They don't do that anymore. But some of the women in the tribe staged a sit-in to prevent him from clearing this land. And they got arrested and they got taken down to court. And the judge, the Indians found a lawyer by the name of Don Jellers, who had recently arrived from New York. They had very, very great difficulty in finding somebody to represent them. But they found this young fellow from New York, and they went into court and they showed him a treaty that somebody had just found in the last 5 or 6 years, which was recently in terms of their time span and their sense of history, which said that they were supposed to have 23,000 acres, all of this township, and there weren't supposed to be little pieces missing from it. like the piece that changed hands in this card game. And the lawyer went into court and said, you know, these people have been arrested for trespassing, and they weren't trespassing. There's a real question here, because this treaty says that they're supposed to have all that land, and how did they ever lose it? Because they never sold any of it. There's no record of it being sold, no transfer from them. You go to the Registry of Deeds, and it doesn't show any sale from the Passamaquoddy tribe. And the judge said, oh, boy, this is just much too complicated. Old treaties and deeds. I'm going to file this case, and you all think of something else to do. And so, which was not really, it was not a bad way to handle the issue. In any event, the case was filed. Not dismissed, not convicted. It was simply filed because it was too much of a mess. It was about this time that the Indian Rights Association became involved and helped this lawyer who was in private practice and working for the tribe to do some preliminary research. And he spent several years doing that. And what he realized was that the state had simply sold off somewhere between 6,000 and 8,000 acres out of this reservation, and that the Indians had never been a part of any of the transactions, that it was totally high-handed, and he thought it was illegal. And what he did was to put together a case against Massachusetts for having let Maine do this. And he filed that claim in 1968, and 2 days later was arrested for possession of 6 sticks of marijuana, was ultimately convicted and given a 2 to 4 year sentence in the Maine State Penitentiary. He appealed the decision and the sentence. He lost his appeal. He jumped bail and went to Israel, which under the circumstances was probably not unwise. In any event, the tribe then retained me. I was working for legal services at the time, and asked me to take over this cockamamie case that they had, because at that time they were saying that they felt that they were entitled to damages in the amount of $150 million for this trust violation. You know, the land had been taken a long time ago, and that they were entitled to interest on that, and that when you added it all up, it was a whole lot of money. I put together a team of lawyers, partly in self-defense, partly because I felt that the claims really needed the kind of staying power that we would get from a team, and we got the firm of Hogan and Hartson in Washington D.C., which is one of the largest and best law firms in Washington, to become interested in the case and to become involved on a non-fee basis, on an absolutely free, what's called a pro bono publico basis. At that time, the law firms, many of the law firms in the country were starting to do what was called pro bono work. You know, lawyers were supposed to give a certain percentage of their time for free. And a number of the big firms at that time formalized that practice, primarily, I think, because they were having a hard time getting good law graduates to come work for them, unless they did it, because we went through a real fit of idealism in this country about that time, which even reached into the legal profession for a while. And they formalized it. I should say that even though many of the firms in the country have pulled back from the rather generous and aggressive way in which they went into pro bono work 8 years ago or so, Hogan and Hartson is a firm which has stayed with it, and they formalized that they have a division in their firm, and they're very careful to make sure that they give a percentage, a fairly substantial percentage of their time. In any event, Hogan and Hartson became one element in the team. A lawyer by the name of Stuart Ross there became associated and has been with me all the way through. And I also pulled in the Native American Rights Fund, which at that time was a fledgling organization. The Ford Foundation had just helped to get it underway, and was the nation's only national law firm, Indian interest law firm, that was foundation funded. I put a lot of respect for a couple of lawyers there. And so that became our team. The legal services outfit that I worked for, I before very long got swallowed up by Native American Rights Fund, and I now work for them, and Hogan and Hartson. And we, none of the lawyers who were working on the case had a fee interest in it. And we sat down to a year of research to analyze the tribe's options, and most importantly, to think through the kinds of defenses that we would face, because that's the biggest part. You know, figuring out what your claim is only half of it. You got to also figure out how you're going to beat the various kinds of defenses that will get raised. What we realized, extraordinarily enough, was that this tribe not only had a claim for a return of the 6,000 acres that was taken out of the treaty, what we realized was that because of the Non-Intercourse Act, because of this federal statute which hadn't been thought of, the tribes that whole transaction was illegal. And not only were they entitled to return of the 6,000 acres, they were entitled to get it all back. Because the transaction by which their land was taken in 1794 was not approved by the federal government. It was outrageously unfair, but that wasn't the crucial point. I mean, unfairness in our legal system, when it takes place that long ago, and 50 cents will get you a ride on the New York subway. What you need is a legal peg. What you need is something like a Non-Intercourse Act to give you a colorable claim, and we found that we had it. What we realized before we were done was that between the Passamaquoddies and the Penobscots, this was really the only place in the United States where there had been a very large-scale violation of the Non-Intercourse Act. That between the two tribes, there was 10 million acres that had been taken in transactions that were not federally approved. Ultimately, after another 5 or 6 years, we learned that this is 95% of all the land in the country that's subject to this kind of claim. Now, theoretically, therefore, the tribes were entitled to return of their land, plus damages for the entire time that it had been out of their hands, you know, rent for 180 years. That sounds, you know, crazy and everything, but when you think of it and you look at the purpose of the Non-Intercourse Act, the purpose of the Non-Intercourse Act was to establish the government as the trustee for the Indians, make sure that their land didn't go out of their hands unless it was in their best interest. In other words, these Indians never should have been poor. If they had so much land, you know, their 10 million acres, if it had been properly husbanded, if the trusteeship had been properly effectuated, they never would have been poor. I mean, it wasn't just a matter of them being children and reaching the age of 21. The guardianship was to end when they could take their full place in the society. In other words, after they had been educated in the ways of the non-Indians. And they had so much property that if that trusteeship had worked, they never would have been poor. Today, they would have been a major force in the state. They would certainly be on the scale of the paper companies, which today, of the 10 million acres, 8 million acres is totally uninhabited. 8 million acres constitutes the largest contiguous privately owned forest in the world and is owned by a handful of companies. They would be on the, you know, if the trust had worked, they would have been on the scale of one of those large companies, certainly at minimum. So the idea of this enormous claim really wasn't all that earth-shattering when you think about, in terms of perspective, what should have happened and what could have happened and what the plan was. Now, the problem, though, that, you know, anybody, you walk up to a person on the street, you bite him in the leg, and you say, hey, I represent somebody who's got a claim to 10 million acres, half the state of Maine. It was taken from 180 years ago, and they can get it back and rent for all these years. But they say, you got to be crazy. You've just got to be out of your ever loving mind, because, you know, haven't you ever heard of squatter's rights? Haven't you ever heard of adverse possession? Don't you know about statutes of limitation? Don't you know about the 18 different ways that lawyers have to say you waited too long? And these guys have waited too long. And so one of the things that we spent a lot of time doing in terms of our research was figuring out what kinds of defenses would get raised. And what we found out was that those kinds of defenses don't work. That this is one area in which those kinds of defenses cannot defeat the claim. Because the claim is a federal claim arises under federal law, these notions of limitations can't defeat it, because these are state concepts. The only thing that could defeat the claim in terms of a defense that said it was too old would be a federal statute of limitations, a federal law that says Indian claims have got to get brought within so many years. Now, there was such a federal statute of limitations, we found out. But it had only been enacted in 1966. Until 1966, Congress had never imposed a statute of limitations on Indian claims. And the one which had been imposed in 1966 only applied to actions for money damages. There still was no limitation on actions to recover possession of land. But what's more, we found out that when Congress imposed that statute of limitations in 1966, Congress said that for purposes of that statute, all claims were deemed to have accrued on the date of enactment of that statute. In other words, all claims were deemed for the purposes of that statute to have accrued on July 18, 1966, the day when Congress passed that statute. And so the time limit for bringing all claims for monetary damages was July 18, 1972. And we were doing our research in 1971. And the tribes decided which way they were going to go in early 1972. And for a variety of technical reasons, it turned out that the only way at that point, although this has since changed, that the tribes had a chance of succeeding with the claims is if they could get the federal government to bring it for them. And so in February 1972, we went to the governors, wrote to the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, and they said, you know, we know that you've been doing your best to forget us since what we did for you back in the Revolutionary War. But and you might find this hard to believe, but we're still here. We still got these little tiny reservations. It's been real hard times for us. But we're in the same place we were when you left us. And we got a whole lot less land, but we still speak our language, and we still have a tribe, and we still have our government, and you know, it's not really all that different. And most of all, there's still time. There's still time for you to do something. If you act by July 18, 1972, this summer, you can do this for us. Well, I spent more time on some part of this lecture than I wanted to, and I don't get to tell you all of the details of what I enjoy most telling about, which is the Passamaquoddy case, because what happened was that the government stonewalled it. This whole issue came up at the depth of the dark ages of the Nixon years, and while Nixon was, you know, one of the areas in which he was least bad was Indian affairs. The prospect of bringing this lawsuit for these tribes made them realize that if they did this, even though bringing the lawsuit wasn't going to cost the federal government much money, it would lead to the provision of federal services. And they said, my goodness, that's going to cost a lot of money, because they realized that not only were these tribes left out in terms of protection of the Non-Intercourse Act, they've also been totally cut out of federal benefits, considered non-recognized tribes, and not eligible for the special services that the federal government brings and gives to Indian tribes across the country. And I said, my goodness, if we file a lawsuit, then we're going to have to provide services. Filing a lawsuit's not going to cost any money, but the services will. And if we do it for this tribe, there must be thousands, hundreds of thousands of Indians in a similar situation swinging in the trees in the east. And if we do it for this tribe, we'll have to do it for all of them. And so that became apparently, this is all my own fantasy, I should say, I have no proof of any of this. It became horribly frightening to them. And they froze, and they stonewalled it, or they hardlined it, or whatever you call it. And the rights of these tribes to their claim were about to go down the drain, because the government was just playing us along. And we heard that the White House took the position that it's time for Indians to stop crying about the past. And they weren't going to do it. Now, mind you, back in 1972, legally, because of a series of technical problems, the tribes couldn't go into court themselves. They had to have the federal government do it, or at least that's the way it looked, and remained that way until the Supreme Court decided the Oneida case in 1974. Where they held that indeed Indians can bring these cases on their own. We were faced with a prospect of losing these claims. And the real problem was that no court in the country had ever ordered the federal government to file a lawsuit. And we had to find some way around that. Now, what I don't get to tell you is all the details of how we worked out a way to force the government into court the way we got around that rule that says you can't get the courts to order the government to proceed. And it really is one of my favorite stories, but I can't tell it. The end of the story is that Judge Janoo issued the first order in the history of the United States forcing the government to sue the state of Maine, at least for openers, back in 72. And two cases were put in court against the state of Maine in 72, seeking together $300 million in damages on behalf of the two tribes. They were both filed before the statute ran out. On the last day that the statute had to run, Congress extended it for another 5 years. We had not simply relied on the courts, we had a legislative strategy that we were working on as well. And that one worked too. And Congress extended that statute of limitations, so now it runs out this summer. July 18 of 1977 is now the limitation period on damage actions. There's still no limitation period on actions brought to recover possession of land. This is just for the monetary damages, for the rent, for the time it was wrongfully withheld. Now what happened in between? What happened in between was that we got to litigate what we considered to be the central issue in the whole case. When we did our research, we found that these types of claims had been brought, actions under the Non Recourse Act had been brought and had been successful, but the passage of time didn't defeat them, and we also found from our historical research that we felt we could put together a solid factual claim. In other words, to establish that the tribes had aboriginal territory, they had aboriginal title, they used and occupied the land, and that it had been taken in transactions that were not federally approved. We didn't think that we'd have any trouble with that. What we were worried about was whether or not the Non-Intercourse Act protected these tribes, because that was an issue which had not been litigated, and there'd been a lot of confusion, because in New York they had gotten away with the Oneidas. There was 300,000 acres that was taken from the Oneidas without federal consent. And in a couple other places, St. Regis and the Cayugas had also lost smaller amounts of land. And there had been some challenges to this, and the state courts had upheld. You know, they said, oh, the Non-Intercourse Act doesn't apply in the original 13 states, or the Non-Intercourse Act doesn't apply to these kinds of tribes. We felt, therefore, that was going to be the hard issue. Now, what happened was that the federal government, when it finally came down to the end, the federal government refused to act, refused to take any action on the tribes' behalf on the grounds that the Non-Intercourse Act didn't protect them. And we, in the process of putting together a lawsuit to force the federal government to act, got an opportunity to raise this issue in court in the context of a preliminary lawsuit against the federal government. And what we wound up in for 4 or 5 years, I forget now how many it was a case called Joint Tribal Council of the Passamaquoddy Tribe versus Morton. At the outset of that case, we sought and got an order forcing the government to file what are called protective lawsuits against the state of Maine to forestall the running of that statute of limitations. But what we wound up litigating and what became the central issue in that case was the question of whether or not the Non-Recourse Act protected these tribes. Because the government ultimately said, we're not going to bring these lawsuits for these Indians because the Non-Recourse Act doesn't protect them. Now that was just fine by us, because what that meant was that we could litigate this central question in the context of a lawsuit against the federal government, a lawsuit which wouldn't directly challenge anybody's property, which wouldn't create any hysteria, which wouldn't have any bad economic side effects, and in which we would get an opportunity to get an adjudication in as calm and as dispassionate a proceeding as one could ever hope to get in a case that is potentially as difficult and complex and emotional as this one. And we won. We won the decision in the district court. It was unanimously upheld by the Court of Appeals. And neither the state of Maine nor the federal government appealed the decision of the Court of Appeals. The state of Maine had intervened in the case because they could see that it was going to be ultimately very important to them. What the court said was that the Non-Intercourse Act protects all tribes, whether or not they're federally recognized. And the court said that the Non-Intercourse Act creates a trust relationship between the United States and all tribes, such that the federal government has got a fiduciary responsibility to investigate and take such action as is warranted under the circumstances when an alleged violation of the Non-Intercourse Act is brought to its attention. Now, once that case got over, A lot of people have always been surprised by this. But once that case was done, the federal government set about doing precisely what it was supposed to do. Once that case was done, the federal government, which by the way had not been ordered to proceed with cases, but just to investigate and take such action as is warranted under the circumstances, the federal government, which had fought us terribly for 5 years, set about investigating the cases. And after spending about 6 months doing that, they concluded, as we had back in 1971, that these claims are solid, that they are legally supportable, that once you have resolved an Honor Course Act question, they're relatively simple and straightforward, and that they can win. And on February 28th, the Justice Department, which conducted a review independent even of the Interior Department, which made the primary investigation, notified the court that they intend to proceed with a claim to recover possession of 5 million acres for the Passamaquoddy and Penobscot tribes, that they are investigating an additional 3 million acres, and then they said finally that for a final, they are not taking any action right now with regard to a final 2 million acres, those being the parts of the claim area that are presently occupied, because the tribes, at the request of the tribes, they are not taking any action or not planning any action against the small landowners or the homeowners in the occupied areas, because the tribes have said they're willing to accept a substitute lawsuit against the state of Maine or the federal government for the monetary value of their claim against these small landowners and present-day occupiers.